All right, good morning. Today I'm going to continue reading through or continuing the series on Nisargadatta Maharaj. And I realized, although it was in front of my nose all the time, that the first half of the page from which I've been reading the wisdom passages, 1 through 200, which last week ended on 69, and next time I pick up, it will be at about at wisdom passage 70, quote 70. The first half of that page, which is like 16 sections, is a very intensive biography of Nisargadatta Maharaj, and written by a fellow Maharashtran, someone from Maharashtra, the great Rashtra of India. And it's a very in-depth biography from this one man's perspective. And the one who wrote it seems to be G.K. Damodara Rao, or Rao. G.K. Damodara Rao, also a Maharashtrian native. And I think I want to read these 16 sections over. It's an interesting set of reminiscences or biographical facts and a story of life of Nisargadatta that complements David Godman's reminiscences, where he is a Western devotee, seeker, coming to India, going to different gurus, where we went through his interview with Harriet, talking about his experiences with Nisargadatta, comparing a little bit his time with Nisargadatta with his time at the ashram of Ramana Maharshi, or Ramanashramam. And so we've got a Western student's perspective. Now, with this bio on this page, innerquest.org, nisargadatta.mg, a biography of the life of Nisargadatta from a fellow Maharashtrian individual who was himself a seeker and disciple or devotee. And that's really complementary. And then we have these pearls of wisdom, of teaching of Nisargadatta. And you can really get a sense of how he came to be the way he was to some degree, how Nisargadatta came to his own being the kind of teacher he was, or being himself as teacher, as a yani, at the in the second part of his life, which is what gave us these 200 quotations or teachings at the bottom of the same page. So this is the perhaps final shift or lateral move in this series on Nisargadatta, which was going to go on for a while, another several, half a year or more, maybe, because first I have to get through the bio in, I think, 16 sections, and then go back to the teachings 70 through 200. But it's beautiful stuff if you really want deep Advaita Vedanta teaching and to see the formation of a guru by his personal process or his life and journey, personal journey through this that incarnation. So what I'll do is just start it on up and read through as much as we can today and go on. Just as an overview, this presentation of his life and biography has these sections. Early life history, daily routine, daily program, Maharaj's teachings, pearls from Maharaj's lips, and then it kind of goes back to his life, some less known facts in Maharaj's life, becomes Maruti Rao Shet, commonly in India or in many Eastern traditions, people take new names as they go along the way, meets his guru, leaves for Pandharpur, returns home, becomes known as Maharaj to his disciples, performs Saptaha, arrival of Maurice Friedman, who was the one who compiled Tattvamasi, miracles of Maharaj, the last days, the last moments, and then wisdom, which is the section of 200 teachings, which I'll return to. So let's start it up. Introduction. And again, this was prepared by G.K. Damodaro Roy, or Rao. So, though a Maharashtrian myself, Mr. Rao says, it was a matter of great shame for me that I had not known of this great Maharashtrian Jnani, a self-realized being, Nisargadatta Maharaj, till March 1992. I was waiting for Bhagawan's morning darshan as usual at Brindavan Ashram, so he too was a student of Ramana Maharshi. A friend of mine sitting next to me was poring over the pages of a fairly bulky book. I gave a sly glance at the book, unwilling to disturb him. I found the title of the book, I Am That, Tattvamasi. This roused my curiosity about the author's name, meaning who was the author. I found the author to be Maurice Friedman, whose name sounded very familiar to me. I was a frequent visitor to Sri Ramanashramam, the ashram of Ramana Maharshi at Tiruvannamalai, Tamil Nadu, in the early years between 1944 and 1948, when I was a judicial officer there in that town. I had seen him there, though I had not talked to him, meaning Ramana Maharshi. My friend somehow sensed that I was anxious to look into the book, and to my great joy handed me the book. I pored over the pages at random and found precious pearls of wisdom on the few pages I happened to browse. This is the genesis of this book, meaning the book that is put on this website, the seeds of which were sown about a year ago. I had no intention whatever of writing this book. My ceaseless remorse at not knowing about the existence of Maharaj earlier haunted me. Added to this was a sense of pride that he belonged to my community, the Maharashtrians. Nearly about a lakh I think is 100,000, Maharashtrians live scattered in places like Madras, Bangalore, Tanjore, North Arcot, and Krishnagiri district, South India, all this, and a few other places. A strange urge to write about this great Jnani took possession of me. I was anxious that I should make him known to the people of the South, who were utterly unaware of his existence. Many great souls are unrecognized by nearly everyone in their community. They could scarcely believe that such a great soul lived a by-lane in the city of Bombay, avoiding publicity. It sounds somewhat paradoxical that people in the Western world knew more about him than his own countrymen in India. We have ourselves to blame for this situation. If by publishing this book I've aroused some interest in him, in the people of the South, and dispelled the unpardonable ignorance about him, I will deem it that I have achieved something. May the ever-merciful Maharaj forgive us in his infinite grace and make us aware of his sublime teachings. Lots of guru-based people are very flowery. It remains for me to express my gratitude to all my friends and well-wishers who were anxious that I should publish this book for the benefit of all concerned. I must first thank my very good friend, Mr. Krishnamurti. I don't think it's the other Krishnamurti, who was instrumental in typing the manuscript for this book. He did it in such a perfect way that not a word needed correction. I must next thank Mr. Hans Berholm and his wife Lillian from Denmark, a highly spiritual person, for all the moral support they gave me in encouraging me to write about this great Jnani. Next, I must thank other friends and well-wishers who took a keen interest in the publication of this book. I must also thank my good friend, Mr. C.S. Ramakrishnaya of the Gita Press. And this was written by G.K. Damodaro Rao. As usual, I will learn about what I'm doing as the time goes on, so I'm not even sure the formal title of this book from Gita Press, but I'll figure it out later, I guess. It's chapter 1. early life history. Vanamali Mansion, 10th Lane, Ketwadi in Bombay, became a landmark for many persons who were seekers of the spirit. Here lived Nisargadatta Maharaj, a great yani in relative obscurity in the early years of his life. In those early years, he was running a small bidi or cigarette shop, offering a variety of hand-rolled tobacco, which poor people smoke. Me too. In fact, Maharaj himself was a chain smoker. It is to the credit of the late Maurice Friedman that he discovered Maharaj in his wanderings in quest of a guru. He visited Sri Ramanashramam and Ganesh Puri, the ashram of Nityananda, and other spiritual centers until he came to Bombay, having heard about Maharaj. With some difficulty, he found the lane where Maharaj lived. He was very intrigued that a great soul like Maharaj should live in such squalor and stench in a by-lane in Bombay instead of in the Himalayas. Maharaj was a pious man, dressed in simple clothes, and steeped all the time in meditation and Atma-Vichara. Atma-Vichara, also called Atma-Vichara. Self-inquiry, so Atma meaning like Atman or self, and Vichara is Vichara, inquiry, investigation, which was the same as taught by Ramana Maharshi, or very similar kind of looking in, or looking clear. The surroundings in which he lived did not in the least bother him. He lived aloof in his loft room, totally detached from the noisy world around. Visitors, both foreign and Indian, sought his company. It was an interesting sight to see gleaming Mercedes cars glide gracefully with their rich owners in search of number 10 Ketwadi Lane. It is said that Maharaj refused to talk about himself, and such information as could be got was only from the early devotees, most of whom were ordinary poor people who used to go to the shop to purchase bidis. During the course of the purchase, Maharaj used to draw them into conversation, as shopkeepers often do. The peculiarity of Maharaj was that he would speak mainly in adhyatmic. There's some strange writings of certain Sanskrit words that are not commonly written the same way in English. Adhyatmic means atmic, atmanic, meaning of Atman. He would speak mainly on atmanic subjects, and there would be no idle gossip, as is the wont of poor villagers and rich city dwellers too. He never used to encourage it, with the result that there used to be a small band of earnest seekers standing in front of the shop, listening in awe to the pearls of wisdom that fell from his lips. It was indeed an unusual sight in those days to see persons who came to purchase bidis stay for hours listening in rapt attention to Maharaj. Maharaj explained great truths in very simple language. Some of the old people living in the locality were almost daily visitors to his shop, and were mesmerized by his talks and would not leave him until they were compelled to go and attend to their daily avocations. From the available materials, we are able to gather that Maharaj was born on a full moon in March 1897. Very, very close to the time Nityananda was born, by the way. His birthday coincided with the auspicious day of Hanuman Jayanti, the birthday of Hanuman, and he was therefore named as Maruti. It's a phrase honorific to Hanuman, I guess. His childhood was spent in a village called Kandalgaon, a short distance from Bombay, right? So Maharashtra. It is said that his father moved to that village at the time of the plague, when somebody who was anxious to know about the date of birth of Maharaj, probably an astrologer, persisted in asking him about it. Maharaj replied bluntly that he was never born, a highly abstruse philosophical statement which most of us cannot understand. Thinking of his declaration deeply, one is led to think that Maharaj referred to the unborn, undying self or Atman, and not to the body. Anyway, many of his devotees left it at that and did not try to find out the exact date of his birth. He was never born. I is deathless. the nature of the presence of the speaker. All, you as a speaker, I as speaker, any being as speaker, or not speaker, or thinker, or knower. The knower is unborn. The knower is the creator of light. Light is born and dies. And so, form, energy, light, the nature of all energy is light, Ra said. And so, the nature of all form, matter, or its deeper hidden form is energy. So, body, material form is undergird or substanded by energy fields and waves and fields and vibration. That energy, its nature is light. That light is born of one infinite creator, Brahma, Logos, one intelligent infinity. That's the speaker. The source is true identity. True nature is source. The source of light is not born because it's not light. So, of course, I was never born. I is deathless. The I is deathless. Of course. What else is it? What else remains when all the forms have fallen away and all the delusions are gone? The one that made light, the one that is, that made creation. And that is not a matter of birth and death. That's the source of the realms of birth and death. So, in a reminiscent mood, Maharaj used to say, I remember being carried on my father's shoulders, which I enjoyed greatly. His father was a poor agriculturalist and died, meaning farmer, I think, and died in 1915. As the income of the family was found, and so he died when Nisargadatta was about 18, we say date of 1897, died in 1915, his father, so by 18 his father passed over. As the income of the family was found insufficient, the family had to go back to Bombay to earn their livelihood. Maruti, and this is another term for Maharaja, for Nisargadatta, Maruti joined a private firm as a clerk, but he had to leave it because of his independent temperament, right? So you see a strong will from day one. He often used to say, quote, better one day of independence than a lifetime without freedom. So this is strong will and strong self-trust. And this is necessary to make attainment in a single lifetime or to make attainment rapidly. strength of will, which is born of strength of self-trust, which is born of honesty. You can't trust yourself if you're dishonest about yourself. Self-deceivers are not self-trusting. And that's what we see in leadership globally. Self-deceivers, deceiving the masses, are weak. And actually, they stand on a weak foundation. Better one day of independence than a lifetime without freedom, he said. Being a Maharashtrian by birth, yeah, they're commonly strong-willed too. Being a Maharashtrian by birth and belonging, as he did to the great Shivaji's clan, his view of life is not surprising. Yes, there's a lot of people in Maharashtra who are strong-willed. Shivaji, I don't know. Maruti, or Nisargadatta, grew up almost without education. As a boy, he tended cattle, worked in the fields with his father, and was a real son of the soil. His pleasures were equally simple. But it is said by people who knew him as a young man that he had an inquisitive mind, anxious to know about the mysteries of life, its pleasures and sorrows. Maruti, Nisargadatta, he keeps using the term Maruti, which may have to do with Maharashtrian, maybe an endearment term for Maharashtrians. Maruti started later in this bio, I think he explains it more. Maruti started a business venture in selling beedis in a shop owned by him in Katwadi Lane. Luck smiled on him, and he soon became the owner of 8 more shops. Then he got married and had 4 children. Though his business was prosperous and the life was comfortable, a vague sense of something missing in his life haunted him. He sought the help of his learned Brahmin friend, Vishnu Gur, who kindled in him questions regarding the world outside, man and God. Then he befriended another friend, Yashwant Rao. I think Rao, honestly, is not an unusual family name in Maharashtra. He befriended another friend, Yashwant Rao, who took him to the great and holy Siddharameshwar Maharaj, a realized soul, who initiated him into the mysteries of life, God, and karma, and gave him a mantra. This was the turning point in his life, and he took Sri Siddharameshwar Maharaj as his guru, and clung to him as his guru, or clung to him till his guru attained Mahasamadhi in 1936. So 1936, Nisargadatta was almost 40. And 39 is commonly an important turning point. There are all sorts of ages that have importance in the incarnation as sort of pivot points, crossroads, cycle end start points. 13 times 3, 39 is common. 13, right? Beginning of adolescence. Times 3. 3 is a big, big number. I think Tesla said something like, if you understand 3, you understand the universe. Of course. 3 made the light. Light is born of 3. The 1 through 3 makes the 7, and the 7 is the basis of all creation. So he clung to him as guru, or clung to him till his guru attained Mahasamadhi in 1936. So he was without guru from age 39 or so. The following year, Maruti suddenly decided to abandon his family and also his prosperous business, so around age 40, and wandered about aimlessly visiting temples and places of religious interest. His mind was restless. He traveled north, determined to spend his time in the Himalayas and never come home. It is said that he walked barefoot in the Himalayan region. There he happened to meet a fellow disciple of his guru, who told him that such wandering was of no avail and was really not necessary for a spiritual aspirant. Somebody who knows better. He suggested that Maharaj should go back home and live an active life as a householder. He advised selfless service to the poor, which was far more meaningful. After deep thought, Maruti, or Nisargadatta, returned back to Bombay. He found all his shops taken away, except one. But he was not in the least perturbed, and got reconciled to the situation, and calmly decided that one shop was enough for his worldly needs. It's an interesting story, right? He went from a householder, married with children, and prosperous business, to renouncing it all, to coming back to it all. After some time, when his son was able to look after the shop, he retired to his small loft or small loft room in the house, the top of the house which David Godman talked about all the time, which later became an ashram to the devotees, both Indian and foreign, who came to him. He lived in this small room till his final nirvana in 1981. It is of some importance to note that he did not yield to the persuasions of some of the rich Bombay devotees who owned palatial residences with marble flooring to come and stay with them. He refused their request, as only a Yani would, and continued to live in his small loft room in the lane, Ketwadi Lane. So 1981. That's interesting. He left in 81, and I started practice in a serious way in 81. Yeah, a lot of stuff was going on around that time, as far as I know. Daily routine. Next chapter. Let me go on and see what the time is. All right. This is a very nice story. You know, I don't prepare fully before I do these talks, if you've noticed. So, listening, you're listening the first time, or you're listening at the first time, you're hearing me encountering much of, or nearly all of this for the first time, too. And so, If I fall on my nose, so be it. And if I understand, so be it. And after a few passes, I understand more. But it's beautiful. It's written really well, and it's better than the interview with David, I'd say. For me. Meaning, I don't connect so much with the wandering, you know, guru-seeking. But this is a really nice to see how Nisargadatta, the personal, how the course of the personal that led to that mind being a knowing as a yoni, what it knew and spoke as it spoke in those 200 wisdom teachings down the page. Daily routine. Going on. Maharaj used to get up at 4 a.m. It's said that he used the public toilet in the street opposite his residence, sometimes not minding the stench emanating from such toilets, especially in Bombay by-lanes, meaning small lanes. We have to linger here and spend some time or some thought on his courage and sense of detachment in using a public latrine, which is commonly used by all poor folk living in the congested locality. He bathed in the kitchen, as there was no bathroom. Persons who have some knowledge of these dirty public latrines with unbearable stench associated with them should ponder over his product. Ponder, so this is part of what happens when I'm reading new, like you, hearing that I find typos and strange things that trip me up a bit. So let me read the first sentence again here. Persons who have some knowledge of these dirty public latrines with unbearable stench associated with them should ponder over his product in refusing the luxury. It's not his product. It's his act of refusing the luxury of marble floors and posh bathrooms and preferring to be, quote, himself and live like a monk in a cell in a very small apartment with no relative comforts. Except, you know, everybody's got their take here, so I'm not sure. Not every monk lives like him. Except for a loft room which can hardly accommodate 20 persons, to which he escaped when devotees, both foreign and Indian, came, meaning another room above the teaching room, there was hardly any decent accommodation in the modern sense. It was a really cramped, small place. Devotees who have visited Maharaj often have told me that he was totally dead to his surroundings. If foreigners could come all the way from their country and hunt out the obscure 10th lane in the Ketwadi area, unmindful of the dirt and squalor, it only shows their genuine interest in Maharaj. Indeed. Maharaj did not wear saffron clothes or beads as sadhus, wandering renunciates do. He had no particular pose at all. He was a humble householder who dressed in ordinary clothes like the poor people in the locality. When we think of it, it's difficult to understand the personality of Maharaj. Because he's not, he's completely authentic to his own true nature, which is same and different than anyone else, true nature. I mean, true nature is same, but everyone took a different path up the mountain, or takes a different path up the mountain. Wherever he is, at the mountain peak, or over the mountain, or finished, I don't know. But each path to the summit is unique. Each being is unique. Their decisions, course being unique, means that they arrive at the same summit unique. Even the view of the summit is the same for all, but it's not quite the same for all, because each of the all at the summit got there on their own unique path. Therefore, each snowflake is unique, but they're all perfectly symmetrical. They're all H2O. They're all perfectly geometrically perfect, perfectedly perfect, crystalline, symmetrical, but not the same. So the view is the same, the awareness is the same in a sense, but even that somewhat unique. So how to reconcile that, I don't know, but that's something I seems to be. And he said, when we think of it, it's difficult to understand the personality of Maharaj, because he's not a so-called holy man, in quotes. As for his food habits, He was a non-vegetarian initially, and later became a vegetarian. It is said that he had an innocent fondness for sweets, such as puran poli and srikand. Persons who were his neighbors somehow were reluctant to talk about his early days. Even Maharaj was reluctant to talk about himself as an individual. Because it's just boring, actually, to talk about yourself when you, with some freedom from the sense of self, it's kind of boring to fall, boring and contracted to make a big deal of the times of a greater deluded self. A greater freed self is not interested in the recounting of the times of the greater bound, contracted sense of self or being. It just doesn't, you know, it's like I don't want to put my head into a small hole and leave it there for 3 hours. Why? I mean, I think it's somewhat like that. I'm not claiming anything for myself, nothing at all. Please, don't think that way. But I have some sense, I think I know where he's coming from. So, even Maharaj was reluctant to talk about himself as an individual. And again, some people get into spiritual bypass. That's another matter. One significant statement made by him is, quote, "I consider myself as a male human being who got married and had children, then met my guru, and after this initiation, I came to know I was absolute Brahman." Something like that. That's pretty straightforward. Next section, called Daily Program. Let me see the time. All right, we're all right. Maharaj was a stickler for discipline and punctuality. The program for the day will start and end on time. He used to get up at 4 a.m., and after finishing his ablutions, ritual purification, he will do Kakada Arti, morning worship. Arti is the waving of the incense or fire. Incense waving before deity. Kakada Arti, morning worship. And so this is their bracketed explanations here for some of the Sanskrit, which are one way of translating. There are other translations for the Sanskrit that he's putting into translations and brackets. So he would do his Kakada Arti to his guru's photo. There will not be anyone in the loft room at the time. And his veneration for his guru was such that during the course of the arti, he will go into a trance and will get back to his consciousness only after an hour. At 5 a.m., he'll go down when the members of the household were still asleep and open his BD shop. He will sell BDs and other articles like pan, betel nut, supari, and lottery tickets. After some time, his son will come to take charge, and then Maharaj will retire to the loft room. Beautiful. Beautiful story. At 7:30 a.m., there will be meditation, followed by reading of the great Marathi volume Das Bodh by Swami Ram Das and other books on the lives of saints like Eknath and Tulkaram. I believe Tulkaram was, saints like Eknath and Tulkaram. At 8:30 a.m., there will be bhajans, and it's translated here as devotional singing, for an hour with other devotees. The bhajans will be in Pandharpur style of a certain place and type, ecstatic, and Maharaj will join the bhajan dance and forget himself. This is 8:30 in the morning. At 10 a.m., he will get ready to receive the visitors, some of whom will be foreigners. It was an interesting sight to see Maharaj dance in ecstasy, forgetting himself, and the atmosphere will be surcharged. There's some typos in this text. The atmosphere will be not surcharged, but supercharged, with such great joy that some of the foreigners waiting will also join the bhajans and enjoy the company of Maharaj. And so this was a daily routine. Going on. Maharaj, before starting his talk, will look round to see who have all come. He said once that he was not very happy with devotees who came there just to gaze at him mechanically without asking any questions, even though Maharaj would persuade him to do so, meaning they would persuade those devotees to ask questions, just like we saw with the reminiscences of David. And so a lot of this we'll touch on points David Gottman brought up in his reminiscences. To such persons, those who just want to gaze at him, he used to say that instead of spending more time with him, it's better for them to get into some ashram and start their sadhana, spiritual practice, or practices. This he had to do because there was no space in the loft room for the earnest seekers, some of whom came from distant foreign countries. They felt disappointed and had to go down the stairs and stand in the room below for want of space. Maharaj felt very sorry for such people, and hence he devised a rule that persons other than earnest seekers should stay away after 10 days with him and give room to the newcomers. Very often the loft room will be packed to capacity, but Maharaj will be happy and talk to them in the usual way, his usual way, with vigor. He was certainly vigorous. He mildly apologized for want of proper place or space. At noon, Maharaj will close the first session and request the devotees to come at 3 p.m. for the second session. When they came back, he will talk again to them, answering questions, and very often put questions to draw them out. Maharaj's talks in Marathi language used to be translated into English, and Maharaj's answers were taped by many of the devotees gathered there. A few books written in Marathi mentioning Maharaj's answers to the various questions put by devotees have been made available to me. I am distinctly of the opinion that Maharaj's teachings are better understood in the Marathi language than in English. No doubt, they have a beauty of their own. And so it's totally normative that much is lost in